Well, you won't be able to buy it in Eastern Oregon.
Welcome, everyone. We are going to get started here. I will call the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization to order. And we will start the evening. We're going to stick to our two-hour absolute maximum. So if I get a little bossy on the time, please bear with me. I think it's in all of our interests.
You guys
will lose track of time before we get to the end of the season.
Mike, the Senate side is going rogue, but we'll have to just deal with that. So I will start by opening an organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting interim committee rules. And Adam, just if you could quickly summarize what we're doing here.
Madam Co-Chairs, nothing major has changed between our interim rules versus our regular session rules. A member can ask for a roll call vote at their request. A quorum of the committee requires a quorum of both the House and the Senate members. You'll find the interim rules up on OLS for your review if you haven't already taken a look at them.
Okay. And just on the subject of the roll call vote, it's certainly my practice that if there are dissenting votes, we just automatically go to a roll call vote. So with that, we will close the organizational meeting. And, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Skipping right along the vote here. It's been a long 3 days. So Senator Farioli.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015.
Vice Chair Farioli has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I have a procedural question.
Yes, Ms. Senator
Does the
Farioli.
House have to also adopt their rules?
I believe we are a true joint committee, and we only do one set of rules. Okay. Now
we'll seek
the
legal opinion on that later.
We got that the first time around.
Now we will open our informational meeting on to get updates from all the agencies and from an industry panel and from local government people on how things are going at the rulemaking level and on the ground out in local government land, and so we can get a sense of where we are and hopefully be reassured that we are all on track. So I will open the informational meeting and call our first panel from the Oregon Health Authority, Priscilla Lewis. And then we will spend, is that the new one there? Okay, and Shannon, good. Shannon will be joining her. Okay, and we have Rosa, are you going to join too? Okay, good. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, thank you. I'm Priscilla Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for Oregon Public Health, part of Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for having us here this evening. So what we're going to cover tonight for you is I'm going to focus on the activities of the Public Health Division and what we've been engaged in.
Oh,
actually, since before the enactment of Senate House Bill 3400, you'll hear today that we've been working closely with our partner OLC as well as Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Could you pull the mic a little bit closer to you? There you go.
I know I'm
not too close, but
you'll hear today that we've been working closely with our partner OLCC, along with Oregon Department of Agriculture, around a number of issues related to retail marijuana sales as well as medical marijuana.
Absolutely.
And also, I'll briefly show you data on communities that have opted out and on the changes in numbers of applications we have seen in cardholders and dispensaries, so that you have the latest snapshot of what is happening across the state in those areas. First, I wanted to talk a little bit about public health's role in this new environment with where marijuana is legalized. First and foremost, our role is to protect the public's health. We do that primarily through public education, but we have a particular focus in marijuana around youth prevention. I'll note here that our state health officer and epidemiologist are working closely with other states and CDC to identify what we truly know and don't know around marijuana use and its impact on the public's health. This is an area where we want to make sure that we communicate to the public what is truthful and meaningful and evidence-based. We are also obviously focusing on our role to regulate medical marijuana and dispensaries. We continue to have a role with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program by issuing cards and through continued regulation of dispensaries. Of course, we have new authorities around the regulation of growers and processors. This, I'll give you an overview of our activities around regulations and hiring that we're doing in those two areas. We have a role in terms of accrediting laboratories. We have a traditional role in accrediting laboratories in the state through our ORLAP program, but we'll also play a similar role with private labs related to marijuana. As mentioned earlier, we feel that we have a scientific role here, and we convened a Marijuana Scientific Advisory Committee to help inform public health recommendations. Members of that committee have expertise in the following areas: public health and epidemiology, clinical medicine, both allopathic and naturopathic, toxicology and basic science, pharmacology, addictions and mental health treatment, and research. We also, as a subset of that work, we have the OHA's Retail Marijuana Scientific Advisory Committee, or REMSAC, and it provides scientific impact that will inform all of our public health recommendations as we move forward. That committee has particularly been focusing on minimizing adverse health events. For example, what are the recommendations for maximum amount of THC in a single serving? Edible products and packaging and labeling of marijuana products. We are seeking their advice on the impact of time, place, and manner of retail sales and of particularly addictive substances. And to date, the committee has met 6 times and discussed issues ranging from single serving size, effects of marijuana on fetus and breastfeeding infants, effects of marijuana on youth, and potential lessons learned from the tobacco control policies that might be applicable to marijuana and particularly retail sales. We also have the responsibility for the Cannabis Research Task Force, and Senate Bill 844 created the task force on researching the medical and public health properties of cannabis, and OHA is staffing this endeavor. The task force will consist of 15 members appointed by the governor. It is charged with studying and publishing report and issuing a report on the development of a medical cannabis industry that provides patients with medical products that meet individual patient needs and is evidence-based. A call for nominations has been released, and members should be appointed by the governor in early October. Membership will include representatives from the legislature, Oregon University Systems, experts with background in agriculture, laboratory, and microbiologic sciences, clinicians with expertise in neurology, oncology, and palliative care, as well as a person responsible for a marijuana grow site. Topics to be addressed include the validity of previously conducted research, potential for collaboration on research with other states, identifying key research areas related to medical properties of cannabis, identifying legal barriers to laboratory research and testing, as well as legal barriers for institutional review boards approving research, and proposed solutions to these barriers. And finally, they will be discussing the potential of locating a cannabis grow site for research purposes within the state. Additional activities that public health has been heavily involved in around protecting the public's health is we have numerous public health activities beyond regulation. We continue to assure that we have proper questions in all of our multiple public health surveys around marijuana use. We have been asking these questions for a number of years, and we believe we have the capability for establishing benchmarks to monitor changes over time. We're also working with the state police to develop procedures for minor decoy operations in retail sales operations. So another area is our efforts around rulemaking. As you know, Public Health Division has engaged in rulemaking as a result of changes to both House Bill 3400 and Senate Bill 844. Our primary areas are labeling and serving size. OHA is required to write these rules around labeling and serving size for retail as well as medical products. Earlier this year, as I mentioned before, we seated the Scientific Advisory Committee and started seeking their advice even prior to passage of Senate Bill 3400. We've also presented drafts of rules for serving size and labeling to OLCC and its technical advisory committees. Committee members have helped us identify numerous considerations as we are developing these rules. And we are working to address their considerations in our new set of draft rules. We're scheduled to present another draft to OLCC's Technical Advisory Committee in mid-October and are on track to issue temporary rules in November that take effect in January 1. Lab accreditation and testing, again, the laboratory testing requirements is another area where we've been working closely with both OLCC and Department of Ag. We have been facilitating meetings on laboratory issues with OLCC's Technical Advisory Committee. Working with this group, we've developed the list of contaminants that we know we need to test for and how a product batch would pass or fail that test. We're working to develop accreditation criteria for commercial laboratories that will be doing the testing. And like labeling, we are on track to issue temporary rules on labeling in November that take effect in January. And finally, other rules for medical growers and processors. So the rules for growers and processors are different, are on a different timeline than labeling, at least on the medical side. We are currently developing drafts and are working closely with OLCC to ensure that our rules will coordinate and be consistent where authority permits. We are not due for those rules until March 1st of 2016. So next, major operational activities. We are hiring. We have conducted approximately 80 interviews with a very large panel of diverse interviewers to fill our 20 positions. These are including 12 new compliance officers who are not currently in place. We have job offers currently pending for all leadership positions and a number of our staff positions. And we anticipate that hiring will be substantially completed by early November. And finally, we develop materials for the public, particularly around keeping marijuana out of reach of children and for use with pregnant and breastfeeding women in particular. Our website is updated continuously, but tomorrow we'll have another major release of our website, particularly around retail sales. So, and you can see these are samples of the posters that must appear in our fast track retail sales operations. So early sales start tomorrow. And we issued temporary rules earlier this month that allowed for early sales, marijuana leaves, flowers, plants, and seeds to members of the general public at a medical dispensary. Any registered dispensary that wishes to sell to the public must let us know 5 days prior to beginning those sales. To date, we know that over 200 of our 350 registered dispensaries are planning to sell to the public. That list is on our website of who plans to sell to the public as long as they have given us the permission to display their name. Finally, I wanted to provide the map. As you are aware, local jurisdictions are permitted to opt out of early sales. This slide shows those jurisdictions that have opted out of early sales. This is also available on our website. Next is a map of jurisdictions that have opted out of allowing a medical dispensary in their jurisdiction. And again, this is on our website for the public to consult. Finally, as I said, we were going to report out on our card applications for medical marijuana. They are continuing to increase. Currently, we are processing applications for about 2 weeks ago. This increase in cards has been steady over the past 5 years, with a slight increase more recently. In terms of the number of dispensaries, the chart you see is new and renewal dispensaries over the last year. The bottom line is that we do continue to see an increasing number of registered dispensaries. We're in the process of surveying all of those registered dispensaries to gauge their intention to remain a medical dispensary or become licensed by OLCC for retail sales. This will give us a much better picture on how many of these dispensaries will remain dispensaries and allow us to determine both workload and participation and access to medical supplies for our patients. In closing, thank you. We're open for questions.
We have heard that there's been a spike of some degree in the medical cards, and you kind of wonder why that's happening, since we really expected to see a decline as people who were truly recreational users didn't need to have the expense or time to get a card. Do people understand, and does the health authority have the ability to determine how many of those cards are new after December 31st, 2014, which was the deadline for grandfathering in larger plant grows? In other words, do you have a way of determining when those plant limits go into effect next March? Determining, looking back and determining what the plant count was as of December 31st, 2014, which is where the card designations were.
I believe we have limited ability to do that. We would certainly be willing to give it our best shot, but we have discussed this previously, and I can't remember the limitations on the data, but there are some limitations on the data as we currently collect it.
So it's we put it in the legislation that people could not have the increased plant counts unless they had the larger number effective December 31st, 2014. Are you saying that that was a meaningless restriction?
No, we are currently in the process. We have estimated about 16% of our existing dispensaries would fall in that area, but I don't, beyond that degree of definition and review, I don't have a further answer, but we can get you a further answer.
I'd like to follow this up.
Senator Burdick, Shannon O'Fallon with Department of Justice. The medical marijuana program knows that it needs to figure out for those growers that are going to be grandfathered how many patients were associated with a particular address as of December 31st, 2014, so that they can figure out plant counts. So it's working on that. I don't know that they have those numbers right now and, you know, would be able to tell which grow sites would be limited and which ones wouldn't. I'm sure they could tell you how many grower applications they received since,
right,
you know, that the 2014 deadline, or since the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I think you know what we're getting at, and I would like to have a follow-up report at our November meeting to try to narrow that down, because I am concerned to see a spike in medical cards when we really anticipated the opposite
right
to happen. Co-Chair Leininger.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the really hard work I know OHA has undertaken. This is not an easy or slow and luxurious process that you're involved with, so thanks. I have a question that has to do with how soon the rules around lab accreditation and testing for contaminants, including pesticides, will take effect. I know that there are constituents in my district who are really interested in extracts and concentrates, and I know also we're trying to make sure that we're protective about pesticide concentration and other things so that people aren't inadvertently exposed to harmful substances when they buy this new legal product, be it medical or eventually adult use. My question is, how soon do the rules that you are promulgating around lab accreditation and testing for contaminants actually take effect so that the product lines will be, people can know they're more safe?
Representative Leininger again, Shannon O'Fallon with Department of Justice. The testing rules have to be filed by November 15th under House Bill 3400, though the testing provisions don't go into effect until January. And there won't be any licensees on the recreational side come January, but of course dispensaries could be required to test, you know, or whoever is required to test, whoever is doing the testing, whether it be the growers. You won't have processors on the medical side until, they won't be applying until March. I think the question for OHA right now is whether or not there are going to be labs that are going to be accredited by January 1st so that you could, you know, make the testing rules effective, apply to products as of January 1st, 2016.
Please.
Thank you. What I would love to see happen is just as soon as the rules are promulgated and take effect in January 1st, 2016, that they be applicable to all the product lines that are legally sold, if they're medical products or adult use products, because we've got customers who are buying things that we want to have be as safe as possible. So I'm hearing you say there are some lag times, and I know this is hard and complicated, but my hope is that we can have this stuff apply and govern testing just as soon as it's been formalized.
Understood. I really think that the issue is just how quickly can, or I mean, we don't have rules filed until November 15th. How quickly can Burlap accredit labs so that they can appropriately do the testing? And I will make sure that everyone understands your desire.
You okay? Senator Pruszynski.
Yeah, but I think I'm following up on that. There's a capacity issue is what I'm hearing, potentially not having enough of the labs up and running to actually do that. So I understand in other situations where if we don't have the capacity to do certain things, we delay it as to going into effect until they actually have the ability to actually carry out these tasks. It's one of those things that we all want to see this happen sooner than later, but at the same time, you could potentially have a shutdown of the ability for people who need this medicine, who's been using this medicine, from even having access to it, if we take a hard, bright line and say, come January 1, it has to go through, and we only have one, potentially two labs in the state that have met that criteria, we could be having a medical crisis. So I think we need to be flexible enough to ensure that we bring the rules out as quick as we can and we get people up and certified with a grace period, so we're not going to have individuals who currently are medicating not being able to medicate.
So, Madam Chair, may I follow up on that?
Please.
I do know that ORLAP is holding sort of some educational forums for labs, and I think they are urging labs to submit applications for accreditation even in advance of the rules to try to speed things up as much as possible.
Wonderful. Good. Senator Farrioli.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just in the same vein, the purchasers beginning tomorrow should be aware that without rules for testing, that the buyer should be careful and beware and be asking in the dispensaries where retail sales will be. And I certainly agree with Senator Pruszynski's concern about we're in transition, systems are changing. People in the medical side need to have assurances The biggest concern is that there is a zero tolerance for pesticide use, because it would be off-label and a federal crime to find any level of pesticide in any sample anywhere in the system. And, you know, that is a problem that we need to get resolved in some way, because off-label pesticide use is a federal violation. So big problem, got to get solved. A lot of folks out there that are going to be relying on the state's assertion that it would provide a mechanism to guarantee purity, potency, you know, other testable specifications, and it is a system in transition. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can compare it with is what we heard the medical marijuana system characterized as earlier, is unregulated. So we're moving from an unregulated system to a regulated system. It is not going to all fall pat like a jigsaw puzzle. There will be transitions. That's all.
So Madam, beware, but be legal.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I will note that the products that are sold at dispensaries are tested under the dispensary rules now. So granted, the labs are not accredited, but there is testing happening.
Right. So, Madam Chair, if I could. So the buyers must beware, and they must self-educate on the retail side, and the medical folks who have cards are a lot more experienced in these questions and the relationship that they currently have with their providers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good point. Thank you. Do you have any parting comments on the early opening tomorrow, the early start? Any observations, any predictions on what we're likely to see?
Are there any lines yet? I don't think so.
No, I've already predicted the lines. That's the one thing I'm pretty sure of.
Burnside Bridge again?
Yeah. Okay, dead silence. All right, let the record show. Thank you very much, and we will invite you back in November for another follow-up. Okay, our second panel is the OLCC, and it looks like Steve Marks is going to take the whole burden here, unless he brings Renee, which it looks like he's going to.
He knows better.
Makes me nervous when Shannon moves herself back there.
She's very close by if you need her.
For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I'm here with Renee, who is going to help me work through the slides. Here to give you our progress report on implementation of recreational marijuana. I want to remind you, when we started off this endeavor, that our commission, we made a strong commitment to have an accountable and transparent public process and putting the system into place on behalf of Oregonians. The engagement, some of which you've seen before, these are the updated statistics, but our website's had 800,000 hits on marijuana.oregon.gov, quite a lot. Gov Delivery has extended its subscription up to 16,000 people that are regularly getting pushed out notifications about rules, hearings, all the news that we put on it. Of course, we did that online survey, which you heard about during session, where we had tremendous participation in just a week, over 16,000 people. And then, we've had this consistency in messages and the process and engagements that we've had, and that's really been, protect children, protect small marijuana growers, don't overregulate, create economic opportunity, and diminish the illegal markets. This commitment has been a part of our rulemaking process for the temporary rules. We've had over 100 participants engaged in that process. It's been lively for sure, but very informative, and I'm really, really happy that we did such an extensive process. It's been a good process for our rules. It's going to improve the quality of this first set that we put forward. We've had 35 meetings to date. We have three more scheduled. And the commission at its last meeting has added a public hearing for the temporary rules on the 9th of October. So we'll have that from 1 to 5 o'clock. So everyone will have a chance to have their say across the spectrum of where we're at on the rules. They've been focus meetings, vigorous debate, and we're about Shannon informs me, and Jesse Sweet, about 80% of the way through the full rules. We'll be 100% before the RAC meets on the 16th, and they'll have a full set of rules to consider then. Show you the process again. You've seen this, but want to remind you of it. We had the technical advisory committees that help proffer all the privileges and regulatory structure around our licensees and licenses. We have the two permanent committees on the right and left in the middle there, licensing, compliance, and enforcement. And we wanted the labs committee to be ongoing because we think it's a vital issue within our system. Those recommendations will come to me. I'll advance with staff the rule to the RAC. The RAC will consider all of those provisions and then make their recommendations to the commission. The commission will see the schedule later, but they'll meet on October 22nd. Timeline just gives you a sense of where we're at in the process. You can see that our technical advisory groups have mainly closed at this point. Licensing, compliance, and enforcement, and the full rules advisory committee are operating right now. So we're moving the remainder of the rules forward through those committees. Interagency coordination, this just gives you a visual of the people you're going to be hearing from today, but I just want to say on behalf of my fellow agencies that it's been outstanding working with them. We've had strong coordination, weekly, daily coordination. We're in the process of drafting the intergovernmental agreements, and what never seems to get reflected on the chart is the importance of the Department of Justice in their role to help us do this. And having Shannon O'Fallon as common counsel for both us and OHA has been really invaluable to a coordinated process. So the next slide gives you a sense of all of the rules that we're putting together, sort of the chapter. So on the left side, you'll see the beginning of the chapter, and down the bottom of the right side, you'll see the end of them. The yellow are rules that have been gone through the process and have actually been considered by the RAC. There's been favorable recommendations by the RAC on all of these rules. There may be, we may have a subcommittee report. We'll see when they consider the full rules because we're going to make a few changes. But we have a process if four members don't support the rule or have reason to vote against it, that there will be a subcommittee recommendation advanced to the commission so that they can understand what those differences are. But by and large, all of these have moved through pretty seamlessly, and I've been proud to see that work together with our Rules Advisory Committee. The, let's say, dark gray are, dark gray are the rules that have only gone through licensing and compliance and are moving towards the RAC for their consideration. And then the light gray or sage green, whatever it looks like on the screen there, are the ones that we're finishing up now. We're getting closer on the traceability requirements. We've had the contractor on board, so we're catching those ones up, and so the full Rules Advisory Committee will see those in the coming weeks. Flip the color scheme on those. I described them opposite. I want to just go through some of the issues, and I've had the opportunity to brief some of you on these issues that are either complex or controversial or just causing us, you know, thoughts there that you need to consider. Of course, residencies on that list, canopy limits, fees, advertising and packaging, pesticides, edibles. And then there's some other things outside the rules that are coming up. Co-location with medical dispensaries is still an issue. The intersection of our authorities with local authority, not so much as the intersection, but just the realities of what that means within how we're regulating as a state overall recreational marijuana. And then the intersection with liquor licenses, which I can tell you makes my life the most difficult of all this. The policy issues seem to be easier than the on-the-ground issues there. To go through, start off residency, I just want to remind you of the goal here that we've sort of proffered out of the statute and defined for the process is that ensuring that Oregon residency and ownership are in place while providing for diverse business structures and for capital investment. The statute, as you know, requires an applicant to be both an Oregon resident and the legitimate owner of a business, and that the and our draft rules then recognize that. As you know, this was sort of an area where the legislature had a lot of good discussions about residency and applicants and the necessity for investment in the system, but the balance point of all those things and legitimate ownership never came to a specific focus. We've had to define a specific focus, and we picked the 51% ownership for residency for the applicant to be the standard for our license application. And then non-residence owners must not be directly involved in the operation or management of the business. Now, we recognize that there are a wide diversity of business structures out there, and investors certainly want to have a say over the long-term guidance for the businesses. So we're working on how we look at that and what statements will be made to us in the filings for the application, trying to make it as clear as possible and not as completely as intrusive as a process that it could be, and one that, quite frankly, would take pretty unlimited resources on our part if we were going to look at all these very differing business structures. The challenge here is, of course, balancing the residency requirement with our opportunities for outside investment. Canopy limits. The goal is to set canopy limits that provide for broad market entry, efficient business operations, and that meet our market demands. The statute says that we have to consider market demand when setting the limits, and that we must set some equivalency between indoor and outdoor grows and limits. The challenge here is we don't know exactly what the market demand is going to be. There's a lot of forecasts around this. There are going to be an unlimited number of licenses, so you have to ask yourself, just in an intellectual context, what do the canopy limits mean? A producer could have on two tax lots different grows. Matching canopy size to successful long-term business operations is a consideration. You know, we want to have these in units that are economically successful. And then, given what you heard about pesticide rules and some of the things that you know about land use planning, we'd expect, if we had compliance, that there would be more pest loss in the future system, and that we need to provide a way for people to comply within that, and that there would be a set-aside. So these are some things auguring upward as you look at canopy limits and as we're thinking about it. Following slide gives you there was a lot of discussion within the legislature, and where we focused was on the 5,000 and 10,000 square feet indoor canopy size, sort of our linchpin basis for consideration in setting those. We did it both at a 4-to-1 ratio, and our I believe it was our grow committee recommended or thought through that 6-to-1 ratio might be appropriate here. That's why you see both ratios on this table. In the most recent rules advisory committee discussion, there was a strong offering for 2-acre outdoor grows, and that's why you see the corresponding indoor canopy sizes there. At the last RAC meeting, this is one where we've asked folks to provide us with more information and rationale about setting canopy limits and equivalency. I've explained pretty clearly that I think the box is around this level today somewhere, and that if there was a reason to move in any different direction, it'd have to be clear and something that I could explain to the commission and something that I could explain to the legislature. Fees. Our goal here is to set fees that are reasonably calculated to cover the cost of the program. Statute says that we have to recover cost. One of the challenges here is it says we sort of have to measure the accounting by each license type, internally balance that. And there's a budget note that calls for the tiering of fees and that they be less than OHA's grow provision. The challenge is just, you know, we haven't done the work on each one of these license types, so we don't know how much effort goes into each one. It's pretty complicated. We'd like to work with you on simplifying that a bit during the February session. This is not to take issue with the idea that we should be self-supporting in terms of fees as we look out to the future, but There may be a way of more input here. Also, remember that we have to set tiered fees for the grow. We have to have a lower tier and an upper tier when we do that. So we'll have to figure out a methodology to account for that. Advertising, the goal is to create understandable advertising rules that really work across all of our license types. The statute says we have to adopt rules prohibiting advertising or prohibited advertising that is appealing to minors, protects excessive use, or promotes illegal activity. The draft rule is focused on children, no cartoon characters, no advertising and media that targets children, and no consumption of visuals of consumption within that advertising. The guideline was people really wanted to be like alcohol rules, you know. Both alcohol and tobacco sort of have either lawsuits that got them into agreements about it or industry agreements. So our challenge, I think our rules will put us in position to challenge potentially offensive advertising. As you know, though, we have constitutional issues here, but I think our rules will give us a good basis for challenging things that fall beyond the pale. The perhaps solution here or route to a solution is to have the industry really work amongst itself to put in place the quality standards that they want to see as a business community together that we can help hold them to. Packaging and labeling, create understandable packaging and labeling rules that can be applied consistently across all licensing types is the goals, and you just had explained or been reminded we are doing the packaging and pre-approval for both the recreational and the medical system. OHA is adopting the standards for labeling, dosage, and for testing. And then there was the clarity that we would need child-resistant packaging, and even that, we see that as child-resistant packaging that is resealable child-resistant packaging in many instances, so it can be resealed as you take the product home. Requirements for products, so we have requirements when we're looking for products that aren't consumed in one setting, and that's the resealability issue, I think, when we think about packaging. Requirements for the pre-approval of packaging, and I can tell you we have a ways to go before we learn how to do that, but we'll be up and running, and that process should be a days, not months, when we get it into place. We'll have packaging that relates to its serving size, and then, you know, cost here is a consideration, as is the environment. Pesticides prevent the sale of marijuana products that contain pesticides, prohibited pesticides, which is virtually, well, most everything. Department of Agriculture, I think, will talk about a list of products that may be available that are I'll let them talk about that list they'll proffer. They'll do a much better job than I will. But they will be working on that. So OHA will certify the labs. Remember that we license the labs. So in January, we're going to have a priority of getting the lab licenses issued for those that are certified. ODA will have guidance and work on the compliance for the pesticide enforcement here. So we'll have a strong relationship with ODA in their responsibilities to ensure that the products that the enforcement occurs around pesticide use. Challenges? No, you've heard these challenges, so I don't think there's anything here that we haven't talked about, so I'll move to the next slide. Edibles assure product safety. You've heard Department of Health talk about their standards setting here, health authority. I think our responsibilities remain the same around packaging and then licensing of processors. So childproof packaging remains important. I mentioned the ecologically friendly packaging. I don't know what the equivalent to the resealable beer growler is, but there are some. Actually, we had a packaging manufacturer did a symposium, and we had many, many kinds of opportunities to look at all the opportunities for different kinds of packaging and what we could do. wide variety of packaging that will meet varying needs within the system. And others are OHA. So let's go to the other issues just so I can talk about those briefly. Co-location with medical dispensaries, you know, I'm having a lot of conversations and people talk to me about those issues. As you know, the statutory structure that was put together really doesn't encourage that to occur. And I think if we're going to look to that in the future, that'll be coming the legislature's direction. We don't really see a clear ability for us to do that. The intersection with local government, I think you'll hear from Rob about opt-outs, and OHA did cover the opt-outs in medical, but total numbers, and we're keeping track and running track on our website as required. We have 9 counties, 24 cities, and 11 referrals. I think 2 are counties and 9 are cities on those referrals. The timing of land use compatibility statements is an issue. It would be great, a better process for us, and I think the licensees, if that could happen first. Right now the statute requires it to, that we ask for it, and then after they make the license application. So even if local government is prepared to respond to individuals who want to get that beforehand and bring it in when we're doing licensing, that would be helpful to the process. Alignment of issues between local and state government. These are going to vary from place to place to place. You know, a lot of attention, of course, on what Portland's doing right now and how our system's going to play with that. And we know we don't have issues on regulating time, place, manner. Those are clear. This isn't the alcohol system. We'll have to make our system work with those things that they put together that comply with the law. Recognize that. Enforcement of non-licensed activities. I think this was highlighted by the mobile cart in Portland, where we really didn't see enforcement take place on that, and a lack of enforcement. Just know, and I'm not auguring for a role beyond our licensees as you have properly given us. But this is going to become increasingly an issue. So how do we deal with this unlicensed activity when we have licensed systems up and running? The intersection with liquor licenses is there. We made very clear that bartenders and bud tenders don't mix, particularly in our physical establishments. But, you know, there's this issue about what you can do on private property and what our temporary alcohol licenses look like and what does consumption look like there. Department of Justice is, you know, doing some more work on interpreting public place. We'll see that and we'll make that work. But until we get clear guidance, we're certainly not going to mix licensee types. This is becoming, we recently just approved, I hope to get some signage out there because our bar licensees are really asking for some help to get them into compliance and to make sure their patrons know they can't consume marijuana products in the bars because they know their license is at jeopardy if they're found to be violating. So it is becoming a bit of a problem there, but we're working on our education. Federal oversight of alcohol. A lot of people are wondering whether we're going to have alcohol and bottles with marijuana and alcohol for consumables. That won't happen. The TTB approves those products. The federal government does. So they will never make it to us for a listing for an OLCC store. However, I think there was an article that covered a woman who has developed sort of a tincture that had marijuana products, used alcohol in it. Those are not actually listed by us, fall under another law, so they would be that would be regulated as a marijuana product, but yet the public consumption standards would prohibit its use in any of our public places, including any licensed OLCC liquor establishment. And I think those cover those issues. We got next steps and timeline, just so you get a sense of where we are. And I'm virtually across the board right now. We're on timeline for all projects, even with some delay in getting the contract done for the traceability system. I think we're catching that up. So we have the public hearings on the temporary rules on October 9th, the rules advisory recommendations to the commission. They'll be finalizing those on October 16th. On October 22nd, the commission will consider adoption of those temporary rules. And then we'll be out doing training in December on our online application system. We hope to get all around the state. I think that's going to sort of recreate a bit the listening sessions, but we want to take the users out and show them how to apply online, have discussions about what enforcement's going to occur and what our rules look like so people have an understanding before they apply what they're getting into. We'll be accepting those license applications in January. We'll do a training on the seed-to-sale system in somewhere in the late January to early March timeframe so that people know how to enroll their inventory data and their grows or whatever part of their process into the traceability system. And someone will have to be trained and certified to be able to do that most likely within the rules. Session comes, and then you remember sort of our scheduled rollout of licenses. We'll be focusing on labs, which hopefully will be in the first quarter of the year, growers and the processor licenses, and then move into in the second quarter. Second quarter, then we'll also be adopting the final rule. That should be about the first part of June if we have a January effective date for our temporary rule. The commission will adopt the final rule in June, and then retail store licensing. We hope to actually get those licenses out in the third quarter of the year with operations beginning in the fourth quarter of next year, so about October again. With that, this is our report.
Just a quick question. Will all the rules come out at once, the final rules? And yeah. When? Do you say that'll come out in June?
So everything that will be considered in June. So our temporary rule, right, we'll have everything in there you saw in that chapter discussion. Those will be there. Then when we put it out for the process for notice it for permanent rulemaking in January and run through June, we'll have to have public hearings on their rules. Of course, we could change our rules based on the public hearing process. So we have some adaptability there. Adaptability, I would just say, would be disruptive if it really went back into the application process itself very much. But otherwise, I think we can deal with what we learn and information changes along the way to tune those rules so they'll work for us.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Steve, since we have the early sale, the Ferioli Przanski program starting tomorrow, is there a way to use the information gathered over the next 4 months to help determine what market demand is going to be, given that that seems to be a question that the rulemaking folks are wrestling with?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be looking at what those sales are and how they take place. Of course, the inventory and system to track those sales and understand the quantities and types is not fully in place there, but we will get information that will help us delineate the market, as well as you had OHA talk about the survey process that they're doing of existing medical growers and how many will transfer over and their retail licenses. So we're going to get better ideas from that data. We'll also have a better understanding of the number of opt-outs that are occurring, which also affect that in market and market demand. So.
Very good. Can I follow? Yeah, I think that'll also be helpful with determining next steps on possible change of statute for co-location as we see how people react to having that co-located. The other question I had was on the, and this could have been just kind of my miscommunication during the end of the session. There was concern in setting fees for licensees that are currently not licensed but are producing products for the medical marijuana program, that the license fees for those people don't in any way encourage people just to move over to the recreational. So when your slide said that license fees have to be less than OHA, I'm trying to remember the budget note that was written. I'm trying to. Okay, great. Because yeah. That was.
Right.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam.
But we won't know that, so we'll make our best shot in the dark here. We'll work with them to have an idea about what their fee might be.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much. Thank you both for the great work you've done. I have to say your level of community outreach and engagement is really impressive, and we've given you an extremely hard task, and you've made great work of it. So within that framework, I have a couple thoughts and suggestions. One is, as you comprise your standing work groups, I hope you will consider including a representative of labor to participate in conversations about retail employees and that segment, because I think there's a lot of concern among potential retail workers in the sector that they're vulnerable to legal risks, or they just want to make sure that their concerns are kind of in the forefront as we're talking about next steps. So that's thing one. And thing two, you've done a yeoman's job trying to operationalize the sort of vague guidance that we gave you and the sometimes varying guidance that you received from us in this process. I will be candid that I have some concerns about the 51% in state ownership and the breadth of how we're interpreting residency to apply to a lot of people. And the reason why is I think we run a risk of increasing the cost of capital since you can't get bank loans. And if you can only get capital from a more finite pool, I think those costs go up. But also I'm worried that in the interest of trying to support existing businesses or local business owners, we may actually be stunting our local businesses' ability to grow. And then when legalization happens nationwide, then our businesses will be less well positioned to compete effectively and instead might become acquisition targets. And I know you're balancing a lot of things, but I would encourage us to rethink how we're operationalizing out-of-state investment restrictions and residency. And then I also have done a little bit of research into this whole privileges and immunities clause issue and whether we're treating residents of states other than Oregon differently than less favorably than residents of Oregon. And I worry that employment is a fundamental right, and I worry that maybe this is not as narrowly tailored as would be necessary to justify an approach like this. So I have great respect for the work you've done. I'm extremely thankful, but I'm shocked to be hearing myself want to be a more free market oriented than I think we currently are in the rules.
Yeah. I'm co-chair. It was it's a difficult place to be in when you weren't clear entirely as a body. And, you know, there are some flip arguments to every point that you made there. It was tough to proffer where we would end up. And I think, as close as what we got out of this process, I'm not feeling like it's the accurate target, but I think it's as close as I can bring a group guys together around that rule right now. We are working hard to make sure that the business side, as we said, doesn't stifle investment, makes clear under the conditions in which it occurs. I would just say, we're seeing, and you're hearing about, and we're all hearing about, a lot of investment that's occurring, even with what we have on the table and the uncertainty out there. I keep trying to balance off what this means when our job is to create an Oregon market and not a national market. And then just remember that Colorado also has had, for sure, a residency requirement for some time. We're going to move beyond our residency requirement. We have ramp-up provisions. You could provide some provisions that help that investment occur in February. Recognize we need to work on this, and that was our best shot at balancing out and rule.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If I could just follow up on that briefly. I'm not sure. I think residency is kind of emerging as one of those areas where we may not have gotten it right, and I just want to find out from you, as we continue to discuss this, both in the legislature and with the people who are actually affected, how nimble are you to basically refine what you're doing, because I think it might be necessary.
Very fair. We'll work on that with you.
Yeah, the question was, you know, how set in stone are you now? I mean,
well, so I'm only talking about the rule I'm advancing in my commission that my commission has not voted on, right? But we have plenty of opportunity to be responsive to legislative input all along the way, and the permanent rulemaking certainly provides us ample opportunity to make changes. As I said, you know, people are going to be in process at that point, so we'll just have to be cognizant between the desires of the legislature and that system we have in place that we try to do. And if there are changes to come, that we don't do it in a way where we tip the whole apple cart and go back to the beginning, but that we can do it in a way that it progresses through the system.
Senator Pisanski.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So my understanding is, first of all, rules can always be changed. There's a process that you can do that if you need to, depending on the circumstances. I also thought that the way 3400 came out, we had a limitation on the residency as to the length of time, and then we have a sunset on top of that, which means it's going to be for naught by the time the feds ever get around to doing what Oregon and the other four states have done. Those residency requirements are going to be gone.
That's a good point. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, when you visited Renee, when you came by, we talked about one aspect of this entire thing that is a little cloudy to folks on the local level right now, and that is the people who are growing outside of the system, the outlaws, the wildcatters, who are operating way outside the legal system. And we know that's happening in our district. And my question is, I guess my statement really is, nobody really seems to know what to do about it. Nobody knows who to call. And you know, that's something that we want to get to sooner or later. You know, we've spent so much time doing good work here and working up a system here that we can be pleased with. But for those who don't choose to be a part of this, really not sure what to do. You know, we've, as I mentioned, we've got armed people guarding water pumps on rural waterways, you know, which is nothing we like to see. So, again, we're not real sure what to do about that, and we hope that you can give us some advice along the way.
I'm Chair Representative Wilson. You know, one of the things that we have to do, we're in our hiring process, too. We're moving forward fast operationally, but probably after rules adoption in November timeframe, I want to pull together as we go out and maybe do some of the statewide work with the licensing system, explain that, meet with our public safety partners, look at those questions, try to understand the roles. And we sort of know the roles, but then the actual practical application of people's responsibility within the system, part of that's going to come back this way, no doubt, as people look to the funds that come from this and how we fund and focus that activity, and that may be provide part of the answer, but that's certainly not a piece that I can do. But as you know, it's a pretty obvious a policy decision out there about how do we invest in this and when and at what level of enforcement do we incur. You know, people are still turning to the new license system, and I think we're changing a perspective amongst the grow community and the marijuana community, and they've changed. So there may be some opportunities here, but like you, I don't have a patent answer to that question.
Representative Buckley.
Hey, Matt, could you just to follow very quickly? There was discussion during session on this, and I'm not sure where we ended up at all. And I know we had the task force on environmental practices, but again, I share Representative Wilson's concern. I have people in my district in the Applegate Valley who have already contacted me about water being diverted, et cetera. To have a requirement to have a water plan for an outdoor grow and an indoor grow, or electricity plan, I just think it's crucial that the license require the applicant to say where their water is coming from if they're doing outgrow grow, so that people in the Applegate who are farming in a different capacity will understand whether their water is endangered somehow by someone trying to preempt their water right. I just think it's a very, that's what's going to really blow this thing up if we don't get illegally clear on it.
Huh? Thank you for pointing that out. Okay. Thank you very much. We will probably have you back in November as well. But thank you for that update. Our next panel is an industry panel. And we have four people: Amy Margolis, Magley Holmes, Anthony Johnson, and Sarah Batterby. And we'll need one more chair. Thank you, Patsy. Sarah, I'm sorry I pronounced your name wrong.
Oh, that's no problem.
Which way?
Okay, I think you probably talked and figured out who should go first.
We did not.
No.
Flip a coin.
What were you doing back there?
Don't worry. You're on that? Go for it. Chairs Leininger, Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Amy Margolis. I'm here representing the Oregon Cannabis Association. We thank you for being included as invited testimony at this evening's hearing. We were also proud to be included in the bill signing this afternoon, thank you very much, with other familiar faces like the Sungrown Guild, Phylos Bioscience, Don Morris, and many others who all worked hard in this building during the last session. I think I can speak for everyone, although I don't often try with this group, to say that we were all, it was quite a picture. I bet we all frame it. The Oregon Cannabis Association is a professional association comprised of over 100 cultivators, processors, edible makers, dispensaries, allied businesses, all throughout Oregon. As Oregon and other states move beyond prohibition, we see clear, sensible regulation. I want to start by thanking the committee for their hard work over the last legislative session. It was the most interesting and high-energy legislative process I've ever witnessed, and our group appreciates this committee's dedication to crafting smart and sensible regulation. I'm going to go down the list. I want to talk in particular about the OLCC process, rulemaking, local government, and OHA. So I'd like to start with the residency requirement. So I don't think it's been any secret that I have loudly opposed the position OLCC has taken on the residency requirement. That being said, we sat down together with OLCC and created some safe harbor provisions with the help of Dave Koblak, whose name I invoke every single time I talk about this issue because he's the best business lawyer I know. So we have drafted some safe harbors, but I am still concerned about the residency requirement. There are some real challenges around residency. Issues of Oregonians being able to raise capital. We think residency requirements that are too stringent restrict minorities from getting involved in this industry. And that is a real concern for groups that often have to reach outside of their community to get funding. And Chair Leininger pointed out that we do not have bank funding. We do not have financing that comes from traditional funding sources, and it is a true challenge for us. That is the fundraising piece. The second piece is that, as you all know from having sat through an entire legislative session, this is not a new industry. Many of the people who came and testified in front of this committee have taken funding already. And they did that in reliance on the ballot measure. Sometimes we make choices and it's reliant on nothing. But in this case, they often relied on the ballot measure to secure that funding. And additionally, OHA does not, or at that point, did not have those same requirements. So what to do with these existing business, and I'm going to call them good actors. They are the people who you want to be successful. And I don't know if any of you had tried to go back and renegotiate a car sale or a financial arrangement, but it's extremely challenging. So we are limiting the ability for people to bring in capital. We are disproportionately affecting minority communities, and we are negatively impacting existing businesses who we desperately want their institutional knowledge moving forward. And again, I appreciate OLCC. They are probably sick of me talking about this, but I appreciate their willingness to work with us. But we are still very concerned about the negative impact of the residency requirement. Canopy size. This association has been monitoring and participating in this discussion. We have members in the Growers Committee, the Processors Committee, every single committee that OLCC has, we have members participating all the way up to the RAC.
We understand and support in concept this idea of reasonable canopy limits. What I have asked from OLCC, and I think is a fair thing to ask, is that OLCC, and the word nimble was used earlier, and it's in my testimony as well, is that OLCC be nimble in their canopy limits. And what I mean by that is not necessarily that people should be allowed, businesses should be allowed to increase their canopy size as frequently as they want, but that OLCC, using real data, and this committee talked about real data a few minutes ago, using real data, be flexible enough during this process to increase the canopy size when the market demonstrates that that's necessary. And again, that is not an unrealistic expectation that OLCC be willing and able to engage in meaningful data mining and to use that to guide these decisions. Right now, we are just shooting in the dark in some of these choices, and being able to change them when we have evidence-based information is really important. Statement of funds. We have been told that OLCC, as part of their application process, will be requiring a statement of funds. I'm requesting as an attorney and as part of the association that the sooner we have a clear understanding of what is going to be required in that statement of funds, the better. Our concern is that this will be a barrier to entry for longtime industry participants. I don't have an easy answer, and I think maybe we don't have an easy answer until we see the question being posed. So we are asking that the legislature potentially make clear that the intention of, and I know this is a rule issue and a legislative issue, but that the intention of this committee is to bring people into the legal system and not to push them back out into the black market through things like statement of funds. And we're happy to continue collaborating with OLCC around this issue. The OHA regulatory process. We are, as an association, extremely interested to see how the OHA drafts and rolls out these rules. It is so crucial that these are thoughtful and well drafted. And I would encourage and ask the legislature to encourage OHA to share these temporary rules out with the industry often and early, with have the same transparent process that OLCC is engaging in. I don't think that this committee intended the OHA process to be a lesser process than the OLCC rulemaking process. And at this point, we are engaged in a very different way with the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm asking that this legislative committee encourage OHA to engage with us in the same way that OLCC has been doing. We believe that this program is just as crucial to the cannabis industry as the adult use one, and that we should all be giving it just as much attention. Finally, our forward-moving issues. As we look to the future, this association has dug into just one issue that we would like to see for the February session. Might be wishful thinking, but we are hoping that this committee will look at the co-location issue that you heard OLCC talk about. We would like to see adult use retail facilities be allowed to sell to medical patients tax-free. For us, this is a common sense issue and an issue of access. We believe that many of the existing medical dispensaries are likely to switch to the adult use market. We believe patients should not have to search out an OHA dispensary to be able to access their medicine tax-free. So that is a serious issue for us. I recognize that the February session is a short session and do not intend to abuse that. But we do think that that is a vital and important issue. And just the fact that OLCC is struggling with that as well, I think we can all come together around this issue, and it should hopefully not be a challenging one. Finally, maybe because I'm just out of the City of Portland meeting, but I will let the committee know that the local government piece of this has been excruciating and challenging and heartbreaking, and you know, the best laid plans, I guess. But I just want to let you know I have participated in more of these than I can count. I didn't even know cities like Hubbard existed. I'm sorry, Hubbard. and I hope that moving forward, we are going to move towards holding local government's feet to the fire a little bit more. I, on behalf of the Cannabis Association, I thank you for including us in this hearing, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. We'll wait till the panel speaks. Thanks.
Thank you,
Amy.
That seemed very well prepared.
You'd be surprised.
I know, the formalities. Chair Burdick and Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Batterby. I'm the founding chair of the Portland chapter of Women Grow, which is an organization that encourages women to participate in the cannabis industry and creates an opportunity for them to connect and learn a little bit about how they can do that. I'm also the CEO of a cannabis cultivation company, Hi-Fi Farms. I'm also a non-resident of the state of Oregon. I moved here about 1 year ago, launched Women Grow, and then co-founded my company. So there are some very pertinent issues for me in this. I came here from California. Let me just pull up my notes. I came here from California, and I think another reason for my presence on this panel today is I have 20 years of experience building early stage companies in the technology space. I started out as a consultant in technology and finance, came over to America to work with American Express, and then basically started my own company subsequent to that in America, and have been self-employed as a founder and an operator and an advisor in early stage companies over the last 20 years. And by that I mean I have taken companies from inception to post-Series C financing and exit, within multiple business functions, marketing, operations, strategic planning, and general advisory services. Subsequent to that, I moved over into venture capital, and I designed one of the first venture capital firms designed to invest equally in men and women founders to try to address the challenges that venture capital seems to be having in equally distributing capital across different groups, including women and minorities. It was a data-based and not a social-based portfolio strategy, and that was based in Palo Alto. And subsequent to that, I decided to move to Oregon just because I think it's awesome here. It wasn't a professional decision because I really didn't think that I was going to find a career here that was kind of the natural next step from the career that I'd had, and that probably kind of turned out to be true, but I did find an emerging cannabis industry that seemed very very much in need of the type of skills and background that I had developed, and I was very excited and eager to become involved, and I've been having a blast with it ever since. But based on that experience, I do have some thoughts about some of the topics that are up for discussion today, and the first one is capital and residency requirements for investment. And first of all, I'd like to mirror much of what Amy said on access and availability of capital, but I just want to speak a little bit about the way early stage capital really works. I mean, I think it's very easy to think of this as a quantitative issue and make comparisons with regard to Colorado and the limitations that they put in place. But what I think is important to understand is that this is a qualitative issue, and Oregon does not have the established ecosystem and framework that drives and positions early stage capital in the economy that you will find in California and also in Colorado, which means not only are those funds not in place and ready to be kind of moved around and distributed between these young companies, but the entire kind of ecosystem of talent and advisory support that comes with those that money that is equally critical to success of an early stage company is not there either. So not only are we limiting access to capital because of the ability of capital to move into the marketplace, but we're eliminating the exact type of strategic support that these companies rely on by working with investors who have experience investing in and then mentoring, incubating, and advising early stage companies. And I think that aspect of the residency requirements with regards to capital are as compelling as just the quantitative aspect of the availability of capital. And I also believe that the cost of capital will be increased if we don't make more capital available. What I've witnessed as the founder of a community of very early stage entrepreneurs and some people with great ideas and some people actually with great businesses and established businesses already, is that a massive quantity of companies are moving into this space, and the way early stage capital seems to function is, you have to anticipate and account for a massive amount of waste. It's not really like trying to figure out how much capital the companies that are going to be successful are going to need to be successful. You have to multiply that by 100, because the capital in early stage companies, what it really does is it just greases the wheels. It's really just the lubricant along which an entire industry can generate enough momentum for all of these startups, some of which will succeed and some of which will fail, but for all of them to have some momentum. And that is how an industry is born and made. And if we don't create enough, if we don't allow in enough capital to create that momentum, we will be very inhibited in the dynamics of the way that this industry is able to grow. And so I think that needs to be a consideration in terms of how we look at capital coming into this space. Secondly, I think there's another really significant factor, and in my experience as someone who's been kind of identified within the cannabis community as having this thing called like business experience, which if you have it, it doesn't mean very much, but if you don't have it, it means a great deal. And I'm completely overwhelmed with people who, I've got to say, the people that I see, these are competent, you know, hardworking entrepreneurs who have products on shelves. They have great brands. They have amazing businesses built. They're hiring people. But they are very much stuck behind certain skill sets that they don't have and that are not available to them in the kind of talent marketplace that is accessible to them and is just really generally more broadly available in the Oregon talent marketplace. I can only advise so many companies. I can only work with so many entrepreneurs to help them just get over the main hurdles of how do you build a pro forma and how do you write a business plan and how do you pitch an investor and how do you know what to say no to, because you're going to get your company taken away from you. And what I'm sensing is that there's a massive deficiency in these skills available to these early stage companies. And in my position, if I had been told 2 years ago that I could found a company and then not be able to manage it, or that I would be shuttered from that opportunity for 2 years on moving here, I would still have moved here. But there are probably a lot of people who are a great fit, highly qualified, and would be very much in demand in terms of their skill sets, who are ready to move into this marketplace across state lines and take advantage of this opportunity, but who are going to be hesitant to do that because they're not going to, because, well, first of all, the language around management and operation of a company is very difficult to discern what that really means. And secondly, it basically, in my opinion, what it's doing is it's stopping the industry getting the skills that it needs to scale effectively. I think that's definitely worth consideration. Another thing I want to quickly talk about is scale. When we talk about restricting capital, and then we talk about restricting access to talent, and then we talk about some of the more technical components of canopy size, we're really talking about scale. And what I mean by scale is not just really taking a company from being little to being big, but taking a company through a series of steps that allows it to compete effectively on a national stage, that allows it to do certain things and be resilient in the face of competition from potentially big tobacco and big pharma as those people come online. It allows it to kind of harvest and become the magnet for this sort of aggregation of wealth around new industries that happens in certain geographical locations.
So we're going to have to speed this up a little bit because we're getting short on time.
So I think we have to talk about that. I do also agree that there's a diversity issue here, and we need to be able to broaden this out and make it available. I think limiting access to capital is effectively tough on minorities and women. And that's it.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Mowgli. We're running a little short on time, so the people at the end always get the short end of the stick.
I'll try to keep it brief.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thanks for giving me the chance to talk to you. So
we need your name on the record.
Oh, my fault. Mowgli Holmes. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer of Phylos Bioscience. So when we first started getting involved in the legislative process here in Oregon, our main concern was that the new industry be science-based, which means that we generate the research we need, and it means that we use science and testing apparatus to make sure that the supply chain is safe for everyone. And the reason why we were worried about that is because the other states, they did a lot of bold things and they did a lot of things right, they never accredited their laboratories and they never figured out this piece. And their supply chains are in bad shape as a result. They never involved much science in the process. So part of our goal was not just to get the Oregon system running effectively and safely, but we wanted to build a system that we could export across the entire country and use Oregon as a model to actually help fix everywhere else and to be a foundation for when new states come online that they can just look to implement. And I just have to mainly report that we're doing way better than I think we had hoped at the beginning. The OLCC has turned out to be fantastic, really. They're smart and focused. They're working around the clock, and they have this incredibly transparent process. And so they're just doing a great job, and I'm really hopeful for the whole system. We got a good bill that gave them flexibility. They're making good rules that are hopefully going to give us flexibility in the future, and I think we're going to have a really fantastic system. So that's the main thing I want to say. I have way less issues bothering me than I thought I would.
It's a rare thing to hear in this building.
You're in the small club.
Right. But of course, that's the lead into now I'm going to complain.
But you have to be really quick.
I'll be really quick. And it is really quick, actually. The things that we're concerned about have mostly come up. We want to make sure that these new testing rules go into place as soon as they can. And I just want to say that ORLAP is moving really fast on the accreditation process. I believe we'll have 4 labs accredited and ready to go by January or maybe February. And I think we should plan to put things in motion as soon as we have that. Someone needs to decide what's the trigger. How do we know when we have enough capacity? But I think the labs can probably report on their capacity to the OHA and work together to figure out when it's time to go. I agree with Senator Prozansky. As much as I want the new testing rules in place, there's no point in doing it until we can do it. And the last thing I want to say is that a number of people here have mentioned the need for a flexible rulemaking process going forward. And that's a big concern of ours. I mean, I think the OLCC is very committed to that. But we are just on the verge of doing the basic research on cannabis that every other crop has available to it. We're going to know a lot more in even 4 months. And it's going to change how we do testing and what we test for. And we just want to make sure that there's really good interagency coordination and a flexible rulemaking process that is understandable and easily accessible, so that when we know new stuff, we can fix it when we need to. Because sometimes it's going to be public health stuff, and we're not going to want to sit around for 18 months like other states have done, just letting it be. So that's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
We want that, too, and we want to hear about it very soon if that's not happening, because I think what you said is just crucial. Anthony, the person who started all this. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairs, members of the committee. Anthony Johnson, representing New Approach Oregon, co-author, co-chief petitioner, or chief petitioner, Measure 91. First of all, I'd like to commend everybody's work on this issue, just as advocates, and I'm as much to blame as anyone, and 56% of Oregon voters, you know, put this on you guys and here at the legislature and down to the OLCC and down to local governments. I think everyone should be commended on their work, and they're doing the best that they possibly can, and I know that this industry is going to be something that we can all be proud of. With Measure 91 and how we drafted it, we campaigned upon having an open and transparent system, bring people into a regulated system, following the footsteps of our microbrewery and local winery industries, while also protecting the Oregon medical marijuana program. I have to echo everything that Amy Margolis, Sarah Bottaby stated on the residency requirements. I think that in order to try to protect the local industry, it, in some ways it does a disservice to lock out that capital. My recommendation as a OLCC RAC member has been to put the residency requirement as a 10% owner for an Oregonian on an applicant. I think that's in line with what the voters approved, because 10% is what is the amount that you have to be listed on a OLCC application if you're a 10% owner. So I think 10% works much better than 51%, although we did not include a residency requirement in the measure. Next is, you know, we wanted low barriers to entry, and the way that this the funding mechanism is working out, the licensing fees are likely to go from $1,250, which allowed vertical integration, so an Oregon mom and pop could get all three, you know, it could be their own processor, producer, and retailer for under $4,000, and now you're looking at a license of more, of likely more than $4,000 just for one license, not allowing many mom and pops to be vertically integrated to really compete in this market, which flows also into what Amy mentioned, is the problems with kind of local control and local regulations, localities adding extra fees on top of that. Oregon or Portland is looking to add about a $4,000 licensing fee for licenses. And so now you're looking at an $8,000 license when the voters voted for $1,250. So I think that can be an issue. Additionally, is the 1,000-foot rule that you legislature allowed localities to impose around recreational dispensaries. Portland's thinking about putting a 1,000-foot rule around all dispensaries and giving the existing medical dispensaries like the ability to get their licensing first and then lock out everybody within 1,000 feet. I think that's going to lock out good business people. It's going to lock out people who've been marginalized by the drug war, people who have been marginalized in this business from entering the market. And if patients do indeed have to pay taxes, or there are products available in medical dispensaries that aren't going to be available in recreational facilities, some patients may not be able to get the products, like in Portland, that, that they need for their medical condition or best serve them. And then to discuss patients, I think that the residency requirement imposed upon patients is going to hurt some of the sickest and poorest and patients who have come here for cancer treatments, for desperate parents whose children have severe epileptic seizures, and they're not going to be able to access the products they need at recreational dispensaries because they rely upon a grower to make those. So I hope we would reconsider those. Additionally, the plant limitations on medical gardens, particularly in non-urban areas, outside of city limits, now that we are reporting and tracking where the medicine goes, I would urge the legislature to rethink limiting how many plants a medical grower can provide for, because that's going to cost patients supply of medicine who can't afford to go to dispensaries. And as we look forward, I would hope that this legislative committee and body would move to further reduce marijuana penalties as we move forward to ending the drug war here in Oregon, to be a model for the rest of the country, and also look at, as the revenue comes in, look at a low-income patient program for patients as we move forward. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Very succinct. Brief questions. No brief questions. Thank
you. For the whole panel?
Yes.
Madam Chair. I don't think we should overthink the co-location question because it's answered tomorrow. Thank you for that. It's answered tomorrow. Dispensaries who've notified LCC will be co-location retail and medical outlets. So the whole angst over co-location, you know, we might all be trying to solve a problem that we're going to have. The only experiential feedback that we have is in co-location. The only experience we have from retail will come from medical facilities. So co-location shouldn't be something we angst over. I do share some of the concerns I heard from your panel and the members about the residency issues from a slightly different perspective. If you described a great case, in my opinion, and I'm not an attorney, for a discriminatory practice by government, which you would seek redress of that in a court that deals with equal protection under the law, that sounds like a federal court. So, you know, the exploding cigar here is that somebody that wants to come to Oregon to participate in a business gets frozen out by what's considered arbitrary, perhaps, capricious, perhaps. The redress is in a federal court, and you don't know where the federal courts will adjudicate a program that's federally illegal. So I guess we ought to solve the residency issue at the lowest threshold of pain, and that would be in Oregon, without creating issues that would be litigable in a federal court. So I guess we ought to solve the problem before it gets big enough to drag the whole system into federal court. The idea of the canopy question. I'm not sure who we're trying to protect with the canopy sizes. Are we trying to protect the indoor grower, the outdoor grower, start everybody on an even keel, knowing that there's going to be a evolution of the industry in ways that we cannot possibly conceive where this industry is going to go? I'm going to share one quick anecdote, and I'm done.
You better.
The Department of Agriculture, you know, which is going to talk about issues here in a minute, I hope at some point. The Farm Bureau offered an opportunity to help educate citizens about growing issues and agricultural questions and pesticides and all the issues that are swirling around the production from an agricultural perspective. So they offered a free public seminar, expecting 30 to 60 people to sign up to go to this public seminar. They have had 3,000 applications for a free seminar that they're going to be putting on. And, of course, they, you know, it's their expense. They're going to go ahead and go through with it. They had to find a new venue, split morning and evening sessions. You know, the whole thing indicates to me that the demand for information and the interest in this industry is exponentially larger than anything that we have conceived. 800,000 hits on the OLCC website ought to be some indication of what kind of potential there is in the industry or interest in citizens. So I'm just going to say that whatever we planned on, I'm not worried about becoming a model for the rest of the country. I could care less. What I'm really worried about is getting it right here. And the nimbleness of these agencies in reacting to change ought to be the criterion on which we decide whether they've succeeded or not. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well put. Thank you. And thank you very much. Okay. Local update with prizes given for coming in under time.
Take your time. Yeah, we have until 7 o'clock.
You want to get another get going.
Yeah, I know.
Welcome.
Welcome. Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Ovett, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Scott and I didn't talk who'd go first, but I'll just go first because I sat down first and hopefully Patsy can get me up and running here. I plan to talk to you about three things very briefly. I plan to do the first one in 1 minute, the second one in 2 minutes, and the third one in 1 minute. And if
we're
I can pull that
here.
Off, that's 4 minutes, but if we can get a...
It shut down.
Because you have to see the maps. But if it doesn't come on, then maybe I'll turn it over. Except you have a PowerPoint as well, don't you? He does.
Okay.
Happened to.
Sometimes it happens.
Meanwhile, Madam Chair,
yes?
I'm so glad that members that are doing outreach have had an opportunity to improve their geographic knowledge of the state of Oregon. You know, Hubbard's been there for 100 years. I know people in Eastern Oregon feel like they get discovered every week that Cycle Oregon finds a new location to drive to, but it's a good thing.
It's a very good thing.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
I got a stake in Hubbard for Cycle Oregon.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
The individual who's going to get the long distance award at the Farm Bureau gig is coming from Puerto Rico.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. How'd you find that out?
Oh, I got my sources.
It's a relative working.
I think she's got it going
right.
She's got something
there we go.
All right.
Done.
Okay, the stopwatch has started.
Stopwatch has started. Yeah. All right. Three issues. Status of what's going on with local control of marijuana businesses and counties. Five legislative tune-ups that I'd really urge you to do in 2016. And the status of litigation. And I can skip that one if we ran out of time. As you know, 3,400 clarified local authority due to time, place, and manner, as well as two opt-out paths. This is how it charted out statewide, basically all of the eastern Oregon counties with the exception of Wasco and Deschutes and all the cities in those red counties could opt out without a vote. Those are the what I call the hell no counties, 55% no and above. Everybody else, both no and yes, everything on the west side plus Wasco and Deschutes had opt-out options in 3,400 but would have to call for an election. Current status as of this morning is this. All the red counties have opted out of all six categories of marijuana businesses. All of the green have decided to head toward time, place, and manner regulations. They're not enacting those yet because OLCC needs to finalize the rules first. The two ones in orange, Marion and Douglas, have put it all out to a vote. And I'll talk real quickly about Early Start and Marion here in a moment. And all the ones in yellow are still in the decision-making process. Folks would assume that it might very well line up looks like the colors on the previous slide. Don't make that assumption. I think we might have a whole lot more TPMs than we have opt-outs. With that being said, early start of resale sales starts tomorrow. Won't bore you with all the details. You already heard about that. What are counties doing? All of the counties that have allowed medical marijuana dispensaries, with the exception of two, are allowing early start sales. The two exceptions are Linn County, which is not allowing early start sales in its medical marijuana dispensaries, and then Marion County is quite an exception. They decided to put everything on the ballot, but they have two grandfathered medical marijuana dispensaries that they are allowing to do the early start sales in the meantime.
That's a nuanced decision.
It is a very nuanced decision. Legislative tune-ups. So that was my minute. I'll try to do 2 minutes. I really think you ought to think about five things for February that we really ought to clean up. The state tax distribution scheme is creating incentives and disincentives in ways that I think you don't want to have happen. For example, and I won't get into the details, Representative Wilson mentioned some of the resource issues in terms of enforcement, especially in some of the more rural counties. I think the existing tax distribution formula is not going to put the money where it's needed. We need to revisit it before the money starts flowing, and I'd urge you to do that. Narrow the scope of the tax forfeiture provisions. I think we're getting, as you can see from the counties, and I've looked at the city list, and I could be wrong, but I think there is no exception. Cities and counties that have opted out of all six categories. There's no surgical decisions being made. You've essentially incentivized a global opt-out. And I think that's exactly the reverse decision that you want to have happen. I think you want to change this to enable cities and counties to make more surgical decisions about what they want to have happen in urban areas, what they want to have happen in rural areas without cutting them off of all taxes because they're all defaulting to opting out of all six. Third, clarify a clean opt-in. Totally forgot about this. If you get a city or a county that changes its mind, that does it by ordinance without a vote, allow them to undo it. Hopefully there will be no objection to that.
They already can do that.
I think arguably they can, but we didn't spell it out. Just like to clean that up, just to make cities and counties comfortable, they can opt right back in. We need to continue to clarify the marijuana offenses. Agree with what you heard Anthony say.
here a few minutes ago. We've been working with Representative Olson, Senator Brzezinski, and Representative Leininger, and I think we got half of the job done. We need to do the rest of the half. And our law enforcement folk are sharing with me all kinds of quirks and weird things. We need to clean up a lot of stuff. We got about half the job done. Let's finish the rest of the job. The latest thing I'll just mention to you, ORS 305-620, I thought it was a great statute. Department of Revenue thought it was a great statute. It's an intergovernmental statute in the tax code that allows Department of Revenue to enter intergovernmental agreements with his folks and my folks to collect local taxes. We thought it covered marijuana. Department of Justice sees otherwise. We need you to fix that statute to make it clear that we can have administrative efficiencies and take care of that business as well. Won't bore you with all the details of this because I know we're really running out of time. The Cave Junction cases continue to go forward in the Court of Appeals. AOC and LOC were successful in both Cave Junction 1 and Cave Junction 2 at the trial court level, which addressed the state court issue as well as the federal court issue. That's all live at the Oregon Court of Appeals. In Washington, the City of Fife cases are proceeding. In Colorado, some very interesting litigation is happening, particularly with regard to RICO, but I don't have a whole lot of time to get into that with you. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking on a case or may not take on a case where Nebraska and Oklahoma are suing them to essentially shut down the entire Colorado business licensing scheme for marijuana businesses. But in this case, when states sue other states, you have to sue in the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case. So the U.S. Supreme Court most recently has asked the Obama administration whether or not they ought to take the case. The Obama administration hasn't weighed in yet. The RICO cases are kind of interesting, but I probably have used up my 4 minutes, and I don't want to use up any more. But the bottom line here is I think based on what's been happening in Colorado with what I would call nuisance suits, using federal RICO to shut down marijuana businesses that harm economically nearby businesses, I think it's incumbent on local government and the industry to be careful about where we cite these things, to not be handing people federal treble damage civil litigation that functionally shuts down businesses. So we need to be careful. Okay. And then
I think I'd like to have you back in November to go into the RICO thing more and also into the Colorado case, because that's the sort of case that we could be facing here. Thank you for your speed and efficiency.
I don't know which button it is. Patsy, what button is it? Start up, Scott.
You.
My sister.
If you wouldn't mind just advancing my slides. You bet.
Okay.
Let's see if you can beat that, Scott.
I'll do my best. Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, all 242 incorporated cities, including the town of Hubbard. the lovely community, excellent milkshake stand right on 99E.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good space. So last week, the League of Oregon Cities held its annual conference. We were in Bend this year. It was lovely. We held three marijuana sessions at that conference. The first was a tour. We brought some members out to a medical marijuana dispensary, let them tour the facility. They got to talk to a processor and answer a lot of questions. We have a great deal of people whose experience with marijuana is, there's a varied experience level. There's people who have used, there are people who have had never smelled it or seen it before in their lives. And so we gave them the opportunity to do that. Next was a panel that consisted of myself, our legal counsel, and Teresa Marchetti, who has testified before this committee, Portland's livability program supervisor. We talked about practical, and the real goal was to get people thinking about practical issues of implementing a regulated marijuana sales, if you wouldn't mind advancing. So we sort of did a this was my presentation. There were five other slides that are presentations that are up on the website. We sort of went through as a decision. I wanted to give them as a decision tree: is do you want to ban? These are the steps you need to do. These are things you need to think about. Are you not going to ban? Here are some things you should think about. One of the things that's arisen we want people thinking about early is what are their workforce issues, and have city management discuss with their management teams if what concerns employees may have about participating in marijuana sales. We know that's arisen in some places. I don't expect it to be widespread, but it's something we want to think about. We don't want people blindsided. And then the issue of you may not want to ban, but you still shouldn't be blindsided by concerns, things that we saw in Washington State where communities were voted for it, but then when it came time to cite, there were challenges. Want to go to the next one? Next question, do you want to further regulate? This is the TPM issue. And one of the things we pointed out is you can wait and see what the OLCC does, see what OHA does. And there's nothing in the bill that says you can't revisit this later like you would with any other issue. And so we made it clear that they shouldn't feel necessarily rushed that to enact these regulations if they weren't comfortable, didn't have a good idea of what direction they want to go. You want to go to the next? Then we gave them some examples of reasonable, we think are reasonable TPMs. These are things that have come up that our members have enacted, mirroring the federal laws regarding distribution of controlled substances close to places where minors congregate. There's a distinction there. Offensive odor prohibitions. Odor is the most common complaint a city will receive in regards to marijuana, bar none. That's one of the concerns with the complaints that come to city management offices. Next is, do you want a tax? This is a big issue, and I think there are a lot of cities who are interested in imposing the 3% tax. The cash collections are going to be remain a challenge for a lot of cities. There are security concerns, there's accounting concerns, there's actually banking concerns, and making sure that your financial institution will accept it. I know that's come up in a couple of jurisdictions. And that was the crux of my presentation. One of the things I like to do is keep it brief because it's easier on me and it frees up time for questions. And we'd always have plenty of questions from our membership. And the other challenge that we've had is that every time we put out a survey or do something, we find as soon as we have it compiled and drafted and summarized, it's dated. And this is a very, very fluid situation for a lot of cities. And sometimes cities call us and they ask us and they bounce ideas. Sometimes we read about it in the paper. And mm-hmm. That's the situation we have. But I think you're going to see some surprises in terms of who's going to allow and who's going to ban. I know that there were some cities within those red areas that will allow. They have gone the regulatory route. And there are some cities that where it passed where I think they're getting some pushback and there's some concerns. And I don't pretend to have a crystal ball clear enough to say how it's all going to pan out. But I think we will see some more surgical bans. I think those cities aren't ready to put pen to paper yet, but I think they're, based on my conversations, that they're thinking about it. I think I went longer.
It's good. As to the legislative recommendations, we will be having at least one bill introduced by this committee that I would anticipate for the short session to deal with some of these technical problems that you've identified and we identified in conversation. And that goes for you too, Rob, some of your so we will be in hearing mode at some point on those as well. Questions? Senator Pazansky.
Now, I guess it's maybe more for Scott because I haven't heard that the counties have done this yet, but what I'm hearing from some of the advocates and what we've heard today, what Portland's doing, it seems to me this committee made a very conscious decision that we were not going to preempt having locations adjacent to each other that would be a medical dispensary and then also having retail and even having those facilities that are currently open, if they could actually have a separation between the two that would meet the standards that OLCC is putting together. Now I'm hearing that Portland, at least, is now saying 1,000 feet from each other. And we made a very other strong statement that we were not going to do that. Now we're seeing the local government circumventing that. That's one point. Two, these fees, I mean, that's another tax. We've given the cities and the counties the opportunity to have a 3% tax. Now we're hearing fees of $4,000.
Yeah, local preemption.
Boy, yeah.
We're going to have to go there.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, it's like you give and then you take. Yeah. And then the other thing I hear that is more disturbing, I mean, they're all disturbing, but just as much disturbing, I'm hearing local communities now looking to tax medicine. So if that's happening, I hope you tell your members, please stop it, or we're going to be trying to do something to get the message across. We have to write everything out instead of having stuff on the record. It's very frustrating. Mm-hmm.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I can't really address the later ones because our members aren't – cities are different than counties. But the 1,000-foot, whether you intended to or not, you built into the actual statute in House Bill 3400. So you basically limited the authority of counties and cities to set distances greater than 1,000. So you said that they could actually set
distances, but they couldn't require anything greater than 1,000-foot separation. So if you were intending to not allow cities and counties to have 1,000-foot separations from each other, you actually wrote exactly the opposite in 3400.
Well, we did it. We made it pretty clear on the record that we had envisioned a system where the cities and counties could have them next to each other. We did not preempt them.
Right,
that.
And I read the way I read it, our cities and counties could choose to have no separation, mm-hmm. but they could choose to also have a separation of up to 1,000 feet, and it says. Yeah. We can't do anything greater than 1,000 feet right. separation.
Representative Olson.
No, go ahead.
All right. Okay, thank you. Sorry we got a little short on time. For our last panel, we have the Department of Revenue and the Department of Agriculture, and I already warned them that they would have very short shrift because their timelines are a little longer, and we will go into more depth on the, especially the Department of Revenue issues in November. So my apologies for being even shorter than I said, but just give us the top lines.
Good evening, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Galvin. I'm the Marijuana Tax Program Manager at the Department of Revenue. I'll provide you a quick high-level update on the process of implementing marijuana taxation. We are currently preparing administrative rules, identifying short and long-term cash handling solutions, producing forms for dispensaries to remit the tax, configuring our legacy systems to reconcile those returns and payments, developing plans for communication, training, and safety and security, partnering with multiple state agencies, including Treasury for banking and cash handling solutions, OLCC for seed-to-sell inventory data, and OHA for dispensary information. We have toured both Washington and Colorado's cash handling facilities, specifically to determine the industry best practice for counting large amounts of cash in a secure and safe environment. These states have developed their practices in consultation with the gaming and banking industries. Mm-hmm. We plan to be back to the legislature to request funding for implementing long-term solutions in February. And for the people interested in the activities of the Department of Revenue related to marijuana taxation, mm-hmm. they can self-subscribe to our electronic newsletter. For those interested in the department's administrative rule process, they can self-subscribe to our electronic newsletter for administrative rules. I've left several flyers on the back table with the information to self-subscribe. And with that, if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Good evening, Co-Chair Burdick and Co-Chair Leininger. My name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Department of Ag, and it's a privilege to put the period on your hearing. You've heard a lot of information, so I will be brief. Much of our work was embedded in the slide presentations you had from OHA and OLCC, and I think you heard us mention several times. We are in the background trying to provide and support those two agencies as best as we can, and am proud to do that. It's been a good relationship and one we're going to continue for a long time in this endeavor. The other thing is that our 15-17 budget did include one FTE to help us implement this. We're looking at the implementation of Measure 91 and those new growers is a new ag commodity for us, really. We want to put our arms around these growers and support them like we do everyone else in our state. That being said, Senator Farioli brought up something that I think was unexpected, and that is the level of interest in the Farm Bureau meeting. We'll be there. But what we don't know is what we don't know. And certainly, if our agency starts to get inundated with help, we'll be back and raise our hand and let you know about that. But it's good. We have had our first call last week, someone who had a pest issue, and it's not uncommon for people who have those issues to call and ask our experts, what is this pest that I have, even just for a simple identification. And along with that, I would just add on the pesticide issue, Mr. Marks brought that up. We are working, and our pesticide staff are working very hard with OHA and OLCC to identify a set of criteria. I think the list is not zero. I think there is a path forward for some pesticides that are generic in use. I'll just use that as a term. Their label is generic enough that it can be used potentially on marijuana or any other, I'll just use the example, green plants. If it said you can use it on green plants. And so we're working hard on that guide list, the criteria. We're anticipating putting that in rule. And then our agency will help filter, based on that criteria, the number of products that we have to another list. I think the first cut of that list was similar to Washington's number, which was about 300 products. We do need to line that up, as was brought about today, with the rules and make sure that that criteria and those things time out exactly when those rules, and then match that up with what's happening on the testing side so that it all works together. We'd be glad as an agency to talk to any of you about that complex issue and how we got the criteria when we get that more closely finalized.
That's great. Thank you for your work on this. Any questions, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, just a comment. I mean, if we're waiting for the point in time when there will be pesticides that are labeled for marijuana, we probably have a long time to wait. You know, and I can understand where you're going. I think, you know, from my perspective, I think the test I really want is when we're doing the testing, if it's residue-free, that's the important thing, regardless of what products we're using. So I just think that's probably the gold standard we should be shooting for.
I agree. Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. You both will be back in November to give a fuller presentation, so I appreciate it. Committee, this has been one of our usual stimulating adventures here, and we will be reconvening in November with Representative Leininger at the Hill, and so for tonight, we are adjourned. Tonight, we are adjourned.